All right, hello, welcome to episode number 35 of the At U2 podcast, where we talk about all things U2, including new album news, tour dates, community discussions from the staff and of At U2. And joining me for this episode, first of all, it's more important maybe to say who's not joining me. Matt Boss McGee is not here, so all bets are off, all gloves are off, all drinks are poured, and we will have an interesting episode.
Is this his first no-show, Chris?
No, he's no-showed before, and he did give us warning, so this isn't a last-minute thing. I don't want to throw him under the bus or anything, but he's not here anyways. That's what we'll say. But that lovely voice you hear right now is one Michael Vox, Answer Guy. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Chris.
This is your second appearance?
This is my second appearance for the second album. See what I did there?
Nice.
Segway alert.
And also joining me from across the pond is Aaron. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
Hi. Great to be back. Looking forward to this one, particularly because Matt's not here this time. So, you know, we're as loose as a goose and hunky for funky, as they would say.
BP Fallon. And Kenny also is here from across the pond. Couple ponds, yeah, I think.
Hi there. How are we doing?
Good. How are you,
Kenny? I'm just really not quite sure how to follow Aaron there. I mean, what do you say after that, really?
Not much, I guess. If you're quoting BP Fallon, then I think that sets the bar pretty high. So we'll go down from there. So on this episode, we're going to be talking about the album October, U2's second album, which coincidentally enough, Sherry reminded us in the chat room or in our Slack for U2 site that it's appropriately enough, it's October's 35th anniversary of the album release, and it's also episode 35 of our podcast. So it's almost like we planned that, but unfortunately we didn't, but we'll take credit for that lining up nicely anyways. But before we get into October, we're going to do a bit of miscellaneous discussions and answer some of the Ask At U2 questions that came in over the last couple weeks. First of all, some big news that I think Aaron can probably fill in a bit more details on, but anybody in the world is formally invited to what we're calling hashtag At U240 Dublin, fun night of live music, trivia, and more happening September 24th at the Grand Social. So Aaron, do you have a few details to spin?
Yeah. I mean, this is the very first At U2 European event, and we're very proud that we've managed to get this event on. It's always very difficult because, of course, we're myself, Kenny, and a few of the other guys in the team in Europe, we're all fairly new to all this, so this is the first time we've actually managed to organise anything. And it was only a few months back, of course, that the U240 hashtag started appearing, and of course it is a special year. You know, September the 25th, 1976 is the time the current U2 lineup met up with three of the guys, including Edge's elder brother, in the kitchen in Rosemont Avenue in Dublin. And this is the time to celebrate it. And so, you know, we've got a great band in the Joshua Tree. This is Ireland's best U2 tribute act. And we've also got another band coming in from Scotland called December. And they've been working gingerly way over the last year in some U2 tribute type songs, doing cover versions as well. So they're going to be playing a short set. The concert is being held in the Grand Social, which is on Lower Liffey Street, right in the centre of Dublin. It's a great place for entertainment. The show is starting at 7 o'clock and ending late, and I'm hoping as late as possible because it's going to go on for a good few hours beyond the encores, I'm sure. Saturday, 24th of September. The following day, obviously, is technically the 40th anniversary, if we understand the history books correctly. But we're also having some other plans on the night. At this point, we're probably going to hold a quiz to start the show up. We're also hoping potentially to get some special guests. Nothing, of course, may I hasten to add, quite like the happening that must be. Is that 1 year ago that something happened in New York?
I think so.
Matt can help us on that one. I'm sure he would remember it better than anybody. But no big promises like that. I would like to reassure everybody. Can't pull that one off, much as I'd like to. But no, it's been good because we've shared it on Facebook this morning. We've shared it on Twitter. Lots of U2 fans who I've never heard of. Some of them I know from various times I've met them around the world, and people I've never heard of before in my life have contacted me today, and it's been great. As I say, we're hoping for a sellout. The Grand Social is a lovely new venue. It was event venue of the year in 2012. And thanks to the Joshua Tree, particularly Mick, who's the edge, plays the guitar, he's been very, very good at getting the venue sorted for that night. And as I say, it's going to be around 300, 350 ticket sales. The tickets are €14.50, which I have no idea what that is in US dollars. It's probably close to $14.50, I think. It's not far off. And UK sterling, well, God knows what that is now with the changes of post-Brexit.
It's a lot cheaper than it used to be. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Currently about $16, I think, is US dollars. About
$16, yeah.
So yeah, once you factor in the flight, it's cheap. Yeah,
that's right. And no, we're really looking forward to it. I mean, as it gets closer to the time, we'll also be planning to do some other U2-themed events. You know, there'll be other things going on in Dublin that weekend, no doubt. I think we're trying to get in contact with Dave Griffiths, who does the walking tours. So it'll be a special weekend for everybody, I'm sure it will. And I'm sure we'll get traditional Irish weather. Lots of rain. Lots and lots of rain.
And you'll be there signing autographs, of course, on behalf of the podcast.
I will do, okay. Yes. Good. I shall be planning to do a cover version, especially for Matt, who can periscope it of Volcano, because I know how much he loves that song.
Volcano's terrible.
Oh, Sleep Like a Baby Tonight. All the ones.
All the good ones.
All the ones he loves.
Yeah.
Loves and cherishes.
Awesome. So yeah, there's a link. It'll be in the show notes for the in the podcast episode. Obviously, you can visit at u2.com to find the link to the where you can buy your tickets, and obviously get them as soon as you can once you know you're headed over there, because it'll be a good time. And I'm sure, I have no doubt it'll sell out just because anything U2 related, even if they don't know at U2 in Dublin, I think will always be a quick sellout, and lots of folks will hop into the party. And also coming up, this is weird. We hadn't anticipated having some announcement of U2 themselves actually playing, but they're slated to perform at Dreamforce, which is an annual conference taking place October 4th to 7th in San Francisco. They're scheduled to appear as a featured guest, I guess, at the Cow Palace Arena, which sounds regal. And you will only be set back right now if you register early by October 3rd. Tickets are only $1,800 US dollars. So you have to pay for the entire conference to attend the concert. So you have to be a pretty dedicated U2 fan to want to go to a conference. Dreamforce is the conference put on by Salesforce, which is the web, et cetera, selling app, I guess. I don't know. There's a better description for that, but we don't care about that. We care about U2. So I don't know. Does anybody here have a connection into the Dreamforce conference?
It is 25 miles up the freeway from where I'm presently sitting.
Right.
And U2 have played the Cow Palace. I don't want to pull a Matt McGee right now, but I believe their last appearance was an Amnesty show in 1986. I hope that's right. I would like the fact checkers to go out there. But it's ugly. It's been there since like the 60s. It's in South City. It's not even in San Francisco. And I can't wait to hear from techie people that I might know that will, by mistake, find their way into this conference and take pictures with my favorite band, because that happens all the time. Because they have the $1,800.
Yeah, that's. I know. I'm not looking forward to the folks who are going to complain that U2 was dropped on them for free or whatever at this conference.
Yeah, they appeared at my conference without my permission. How do I get them off?
Yeah, and yeah, I stayed in a hotel somewhere near the Cow Palace one time when I was visiting San Francisco, and I can, just from afar, anyways, it definitely does not look very.
It's not the Sydney Opera House.
No,
let's just say that.
Yeah, those would be the two good two extremes.
The two extremes, right?
So anyways, but either way, it's still cool. It's obviously a tie-in from Salesforce being – is it Salesforce? For some reason, that feels wrong, but maybe somebody will correct me afterwards. But anyway, Salesforce sponsoring a bit of the tour and stuff like that, and being involved with you two that way. So there's some sort of tie in there. There's much gnashing of teeth over, you know, is this you two selling out or not, and all those kinds of things, which we'll save for Twitter discussions and arguments at maybe in Dublin at the U240 special. But at any rate, something to look forward to, and hopefully somebody will be in there who is a legit U2 fan. I'm sure there will be more than one or two that will be streaming and or reporting anyways on how the band plays and what they play, all that kind of stuff. So mark that on your calendars, I guess. And let's move on to the inbox segment of our podcast, the Ask You Two questions that folks have submitted via Twitter using the hashtag AskAtU2. We have a bunch of interesting questions and some that are related to our October discussion, so we'll save those for the when we get to that in the roundtable. But first up, from at Lionholic, what are the best unofficial U2 albums out there? Bootlegs, fruitlegs, unofficial collections, etc. Does anybody have a favorite unofficial U2 album?
Ooh, for me, I quite enjoyed what is, I think it's probably called the Gobbledygook tapes. So, you know, this is the Acton Baby pre-recordings.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Going back to 1990. I mean, you know, there's so many different things to listen to. I mean, I had that, I must have got that a long, long time ago on a cassette. And I know that since then it's come out as Salome or something like that. And there's about six CDs worth. And it goes on for hours and hours and hours. So that was always very interesting because there's lots of tracks on there that it was great to have because you weren't supposed to have it. That was the thrill of it all. Of course, you know, imagine stealing music for free nowadays. Eh? Good God. It wouldn't happen, would it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one, and definitely getting to hear like early nuggets of songs that sort of became something different, parts that were used for other songs, and getting a peek inside the U2's songwriting process.
Yeah, that's right. And since the anniversary of Acton Baby, you know, you know, with Bono and Edge explaining how many of the songs were formed, you know, between One and Mysterious Ways, kind of split off into two different songs, and you can hear that actually very much on these recordings, which go back to early 1990, you know, almost a good 2 years before the eventual release of Acton Baby.
Yeah.
So that's my favorite.
The one I know, I don't know if this would be, I guess, an unofficial release of sorts, but the one I always listen to a lot, used to listen to a ton, is the outside broadcast of the Zoo TV tour. Mm. I guess it was kind of like an official release, but it wasn't released as an album, so I don't know if that qualifies. Sorry, at Lionholic, if we're breaking the rules of your question, but it's our podcast. So, but yeah, definitely the interspersed with the sort of communication and radio static and whatever stuff that they kind of interspersed into the live recording, I think was just kind of, especially for someone who hadn't seen the show, had only seen the VHS or whatever, was just kind of a good way to reminisce.
It did have the chaos of the live show. That's a great one. Because yeah, there are those radio bits, and I think, isn't someone trying to get into the studio and Bono's knocking on the door and yeah, they do skits almost?
Yeah, it's a weird one, especially thinking of them now, the band now, and not that they take themselves ultra seriously, but they definitely kind of don't have the same kind of fun with some of the media and promotion stuff that they do the way they used to. So how about you?
I got a couple for older people. The Rosemont Horizon show from Chicago was by far the most popular one. Whenever I talked to friends that wanted to talk about the bootlegs they had found, I feel like it's either Joshua Tree or Unforgettable Fire, probably Joshua Tree. And then we're talking about October today, and I've been listening a lot just to see what these songs sounded like early live. They played a radio promo show on a riverboat in New Orleans, you know, 4 months after the release of this. It's called Riverboat President, and it's just a young band. It's from February of 82.
Do I have that? That's the Steamboat one, isn't it?
Yeah, the Steamboat one. And it's pretty good. It's a tight set, and they play just boy. They only had two albums to work with, so they played, I don't know, 15 songs. But you can just hear their eagerness. It just comes shooting out, right? And they know they're losing the crowd when they're singing about God, and yet they keep doing it. But I guess that's more of a discussion when we get to the October stuff. Those are the two that I like.
Yeah, Fabiano in the chat room asks if I'll be inserting a link of these bootlegs in the podcast note. There's Google. Yeah, Google has a way. Kenny, anything jump out for you?
To be honest, I think the main one for me is it was a bootleg off the War Tour, Glasgow Tiffany's.
Yes.
And part of the reason, I mean, apart from obviously it's in Scotland, it's actually my very first ever U2 show. So I had the joy of the fact that somebody, and I only discovered this later on, that somebody had had obviously bootlegged it. So, and I like it just because it was quite a calamitous night. Bono did what he did a lot in those days, which was forget his lyrics. He obviously didn't have teleprompters and all that kind of sort of stuff. But yeah, that's a favourite of mine.
Was it, so it was a show you were at as well as got to hear, or...?
I was at it as well. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. So that, yeah. That is awesome. Yeah, so that's kind of wild. That was, yeah, that was my very first ever YouTube
That's called
show.
A Night at Tiffany's. If you bought it in the U.S., I think I got a record version of that. But I think doesn't he sing "You Take the High Road, I'll Take the Low Road"?
And that's exactly he does.
Right?
He does.
Oh my
that's
god!
Right.
Yeah. I love. And like I don't even know enough about bootlegs, but that's one I always remember. Yeah. Good choice, dude.
Yeah, it's a funny bit of. Synergy to that.
And you were there. I think I heard you cheering. Oh my god, that was years ago.
Kenny, when I saw you in Dublin, you were still wearing that t-shirt you bought that night.
That's an outrage. Don't need
that. There's actually part of the show when you can hear there's somebody tries to storm the stage and he talks about the security and stuff like that. That was me. It wasn't really, by the way, I'm just saying that. But.
Awesome. That's very cool. Yeah, I remember finding I was at a U2 the Pop Mart show in Edmonton in Alberta and then finding the bootleg later or whatever from some fan there or whatever. And it's just like it wasn't an amazing show. It ended with a thunderstorm or whatever, and it was kind of fun that way, but just hearing the show that you were at or whatever is just kind of special and neat and thankful for all the U2 fans who do record stuff and especially back in the day. These days it seems like everybody's got there's tons of video and audio from shows, but having some of the older stuff is kind of cool. So we'll do our best to point you in the right direction of something that is hopefully legal to find those. All right, moving on. At Ranting Geeks asked, if you could hear one U2 album in full, what would it be? My choice is Achtung Baby. After all these years, it's a true masterpiece. And I'm assuming they mean live. Obviously, we can hear the album in full if you want to. Kenny, do you have a response for Ranting Geeks?
I'd actually go with Boy, just simply because they don't play an awful lot of that stuff these days, and I kind of missed. I got some of it, but I kind of missed a lot of that stuff, and I just think that would be, I think that would be. I it'd just be fantastic, actually. So I was going to cheat and say Boy, October and War, because I'd love to actually hear that entire trilogy, but I'm not actually entirely sure if that's breaking the rule of the question. but certainly if I was going to choose one of those three, I would go with Boy, just simply because, as I say, I had less opportunity to hear that stuff live.
Right. Aaron, how about you?
Yeah, actually it's interesting. I was just thinking that and... You know, my favourite album, definitely Achtung Baby, but I mean, I've heard the track so many times. But Boy, for me again, because, you know, it's not an album that I grew up with. You know, it was one or two years old before I became a U2 fan. But I heard a lot of the tracks live, as Kenny would have done, around the War Tour time. And it's been a long time since some of the tracks... have been played live, and certainly since I've heard them. I mean, I'm just thinking of A Day Without Me, for instance, Kenny. You know, I would have loved to have heard that again on the last tour, particularly being the Songs of Innocence tour, you know. And okay, they jump back to I Will Follow, they jump back to Out of Control, Some of the Nights, and things like Stories for Boys. You don't hear them enough anymore. You know, they played Anka Dove and Into the Heart back on, was that Vertigo tour? I can't remember now. No, it wasn't Vertigo. It was...
I think it was Vertigo.
Might have been Vertigo. Yeah. So, I'd love to hear those songs again, but played by the same guys, you know, 36, 37 years on from when they were written, one after the other. It'd be just great.
Yeah. And how about you, Michael? Anything that's
I sort of hear this question as what is your favorite album, which is Joshua Tree for me, and I have heard all of the songs live, but never in album order. And I don't know how important that is, but to have both One Tree Hill and Mothers of the Disappeared at the same show to send everybody out in a bad mood would be one of those fantastic. Anything in its entirety would be great because they'd have to play those songs we haven't heard.
Yeah.
Right. Along with the ones we're all waiting for. And, you know, I mean, that's how we originally heard them in the old days when you had to play a record from start to finish.
Yeah.
There's actually quite a lot of musical acts doing that now. I mean, inevitably it's heritage, a bit more heritage acts. But, I mean, for instance, I have seen Lou Reed play Berlin from start to finish, and that was probably about 6-7 years ago. And the album would have been around 35 years old at that point. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that was 2-3 weeks ago. I saw Adam Ant play Kings of the Wild Frontier album from start to finish. And they really are fantastic shows if you're really into the album. They kind of lose the audience if the audience is just there to hear their single or they're there to hear a Grace Hit show, because they don't do that. You know, saying Lou Reed never played Grace Hit show. You know, that wasn't his style. Yeah. And I, you know, as much as I'd love you to do it, I don't want them to do it because it kind of means that they're getting a bit...
long
in the tooth and whatever, but it would be brilliant just to have that treat.
Yeah, it's one of those things that even as the artist, you think of they didn't play the album, you know, start to finish that way either. They record the album in, you know, songs or whatever in various orders and then piece it together after the fact, and probably have never done it themselves either. So it's kind of an interesting experiment, but I could see you two doing it in, like, you know, some future days where they're just like broadcasting from the studio as they, you know, Adam rolls out of the shower in his bathrobe and they just show up and play the album as a special event or whatever, but not like going around the world playing Achtung Baby over and over and over kind of thing. But it's a fun question to answer anyways, too. So, yeah. So one similar question from Ranting Geeks was, if you could rearrange the track listing for one album, what would it be? And for this person, it was All That You Can't Leave Behind could flow a bit better. Kenny, how about you? What, anything?
I mean, I had to really look at that and I thought, and actually, I'm actually quite settled with all the track listing. I'm probably easy come, easy go when it comes to that stuff. However, if I was going to just go and look at one, it would be pop, actually. And I'd love them to start off with Mofo as opposed to Discotheque, just because it's such a driving, heavy song. So I think that's the one. Whenever I listen to that album, I think it just doesn't land quite right for me where Mofo sits, and it just feels like it would be better at the head or at the beginning of that record as opposed to sort of kind of third in line. It doesn't feel like I think it's third anyway.
Yeah.
So that would be my choice, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Aaron? Anything that you?
I agree with. Who's the chap who's just wrote in? Ranting Geek.
Mr. Geek to you.
Yeah. Mr. Geek to me, yeah. Yeah, I would agree with All That You Can't Leave Behind. And the reason for that is very simple. That was probably the first album I downloaded for free. Obviously bought it in 29 different versions since, but I bought that and downloaded that off some dodgy website at the time. And cut it onto a CD, but in the wrong order.
Oh, interesting.
And I've still got that CD, and basically my CD goes like this: Beautiful Day, Elevation, Stuck in a Moment, rather than Beautiful Day, Stuck in a Moment, Elevation. So even and despite probably listening to All That You Can't Leave Behind not as much now as I used to, I still have Elevation. I'm expecting Elevation to kick in straight after Beautiful Day. So for me, my mistake, because I listened to the album nonstop for about 3 weeks before it was actually released, I'm always expecting Elevation to kick in after Beautiful Day. And to me, it's much better that way. So yeah. I reckon they should do a product recall and get all those albums.
Yeah.
The Aaron remix. For me, there's something about, I think from listening to Achtung Baby so often, I agree with you, Aaron, that having the third song be like the emotional, you know, heart-wrenching, whatever kind of song fits to me with my mind in U2. Not that they've done it on every album, but like with one being song three, then it feels like that's the template. You do that one and then number three is always like the one that kind of you build up to and have sort of a bit of the more emotional release or whatever. So, but we're going to keep moving because we're going to end up just having a question and answer time. Be the whole podcast. We won't actually get to October, which at Charaf asked, I'm a new U2 fan, yet I'm Bono's age. Welcome to the U2 fan club. I was wondering, when U2 sponsored the iPod years ago, was it preloaded with U2 music? Michael, do you have a, you did some researching.
I just know that, the one that was black and red, which was cooler than the others, this was the kind that you could, turn your thumb around. I'm making a thumb motion right now. Can you guys see that? No, you can't. All right. But it was substantially more expensive. I feel like it was $500 just to start with. And you could, in fact, Chris says, download the entire, whatever was available at iTunes at the time, all at once as part of the price.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know any other fans that have that. Like, I have it.
Yeah, yeah. I bought it, but I didn't. See, I can remember it because I couldn't see the point of buying the version with the digital box set, which came with some type of little code or whatever. I mean, when was this? This was year 2000 or 2001, wasn't it? It has to be because it came out around, oh, no, no. What am I talking about?
No,
2005.
Because it's black and red.
It'd be How to Dismantle Atomic Bomb, wasn't it? Of course it was, yeah.
Yep.
And it came in two options for me, certainly in the UK. One with the digital box set, which you downloaded from iTunes, the old iTunes, of course. And then the one where you just bought the iPod itself. And I bought that one with the thumb and the LED display.
Yeah.
I still have one of those, you guys, in my car.
I've got it as well.
Once in a while.
Do you have? Is it the autograph? Like the band signature in the back, right?
That's it. Yep, that's right.
I've got that as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's it came with a $50 coupon for the purchase of the U2 Digital Complete Works. Which so I'm just referencing an old article on U2.com, actually, a popular site among U2 fans. that still has it up. It's funny when you stumble across these. This is from October 2004. So. October. Wow. But yeah, you stumble across these articles and read it as if it's put out today, and they still have the link to buy it from apple.com and stuff on it. But it was a 20 gig iPod holding up to 5,000 songs, a beautiful machine. That's what they describe it as.
It did look cool. I gotta say, the red was, I mean, it totally separated the haves from the have nots. Mine was black without the red. But yeah, that thing was...
I still use mine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean. Yep.
Yeah, those are ones with the spinning disc in it too, so it's like an actual little tiny hard drive.
You can hear it.
Which is pretty incredible when you think of, what is that now, 14, 16 years, I guess, going on, and yours is still spinning, so.
Yeah, it was quite good. It was 20 gig or 30 gig mine, I think, and I remember getting the next, I think there was three different versions. I probably got the last one as well, which was the color screen. But I mean, very basic color screen. I don't even remember whether it might have played some very poor video as well. And then I think the iPod Touch arrived and obviously that changed the whole ethos.
Yeah. No more U2 iPod Touch, unfortunately. Sure. Until Bono touched Tim Cook and then we had the new album. All right. So the other questions, a couple of the other questions came in and are related to a bit more to talking about October. So what we're doing, in case this is your first ever podcast you've listened to at the U2 podcast, we're in lieu of the hashtag U240, the 40th anniversary of U2 coming together, as Aaron alluded to earlier, we're going from Boy to Songs of Innocence and talking about all the albums, each an album per episode. And if we're lucky, we'll end and then U2 will release the next album just in time, or if not sooner. And so we started with episode 34. So if you're just tuning in, want to go back, you can go to goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34. And that'll get you right to the Boy discussion, which we had in the previous episode. So this episode, we're talking October. And so a couple of the questions that we'll just quickly go over, and at Bruno Caffey mentioned, am I the only one that mistook Scarlet for Rejoice? Because in Scarlet, the only lyric is Rejoice, which I'll confess up front that I'll probably do less talking in this discussion because earlier U2 is not as something that's as commonly played in my playlist, I guess, over the years, CDs and now, you know, in iTunes and stuff as we play them. And so some of them, if it's just playing on air or on the speakers or whatever, on random and stuff like that, they do kind of blend, the earlier stuff kind of blends together for me a bit more. And something else that we want to talk about, speaking of December, the band that's going to be at the U240 party in Dublin, they tweeted at us asking, why do you think October seems to be one of the least appreciated albums, at least in forum polls, etc.? Should say for us, it's a real favorite, all the seeking and reaching for something not quite in their grasp yet. So that's definitely something we will cover. And was it Kenny or Aaron in the chat room, Slack, you were mentioning in the forum, there's quite a healthy discussion about October itself.
Yeah, it was me who mentioned it, because I actually started the thread off many, many years ago, so I did. And part of the reason I did, actually, because, I mean, I think I mentioned this the last time I was on the podcast. I guess it doesn't get much love, this album, and I've got a lot of time for it, so I do. So actually, I probably couldn't say it quite as eloquently there as December did. But anyway, yes, we started a thread in there. I think it's sitting at 356 pages or something like that. I do wow. have to say I've probably contributed to most of that just to keep it alive. It hasn't been posted in for a wee bit, but no, there was a fair bit of discussion, and it does draw that kind of love hate dynamic actually across the kind of U2 population. So it does.
So is it without transcribing all 35 pages? Is it kind of like a bit of a debate going on as to why or how and?
There's kind of a mix of things. So there's kind of, it's an appreciation thread. So it's the October worship thread is what it's titled.
Nice.
So it's all as sad October people go and just wax lyrically about why such a certain song resonates, etc. But you do get the kind of debate about, you know, why does it get, you know, constantly within the forum polls, it does come bottom all the time. So there's always discussions around about that stuff. So, but that's where we try and keep the October flame alive. So that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Got to have the album fans. There's the pop fans as well who keep the pop popularity alive. And
I was going to say that this is for millennials, pop is their October, right? Like they have to defend it to people. People say, well, what should I listen to? They have to find the one song that won't make them vomit. Kind of like we have to go like, try Tomorrow, right? Like I was just looking at the set list the track list, what song I would send a friend to get like the idea of October. Right. You don't want them to play actual October because then they'll think it's a piano thing, or Scarlet for God's sakes, because it has one word. So you have to find, you know, and they've heard Gloria before, but it is not particularly chock full of hits. I also noticed that the Greatest Hits album only included October as the hidden track. None of these others track, made it, right?
They didn't want to even name it. Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously, it can't even speak its name. It's the love that can't speak its name. The album October. That's why we're here.
So here, Aaron, by way of introduction to the album too, do you have some opening, almost like we're defending October, I guess, but opening comments before?
Well, I think just listening to what you guys have said, there's a different relationship depending on your age, or not so much your age, the length of time you've been a U2 fan. And I guess, I mean, I'm 47, and October was my first album, but it was already around just over a year old by the time I got it. So for me, it was contemporary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, I go out and, I mean, I remembered the album being in the stores. I can remember the album sleeve because, of course, in the UK, it did rather well. It got to number 11 in the charts, and a number 11 in the charts in 1981 would be a number one for 7 weeks. You know, in today's terms, because it would have sold nearly 250,000, I think it would have sold. So it was a quite a commercial success in some respects for a young band. And U2 had been heavily promoted at the time in 1981. So for me, being a 13, 14-year-old chap who's getting madly into music and soaking up everything every time he walked into a record shop and there was big promos, whatever, you know, I can remember the album being there, albeit I didn't actually get to buy it until I think it was January 1983 when New Year's Day came in. And that was it. When I heard that, I thought, right, this is it. I'm going to start buying the back catalogue. And I actually listened to it the wrong way around. I listened to October first and then Boy. So I have a very different relationship perhaps than somebody who's become a U2 fan in the late, I don't know, let's just say the late 1980s or the late 1990s. And I can imagine if you're listening to it as a 25-year-old, as a millennial, you'll think to yourself, it sounds really dated, just the sound, Bono's voice. He's, as he says, he sings like a girl. That's what he says. And I can't hear that, but other people will, because they'll hear the different, the tone of his voice, the different maturing of his voice as it is now. You know, regarding the rest of the band, you can't really tell when it was recorded as such, because it, you know, it's remarkable for them being 20, 22-year-old young kids, because as musicians, they'd only been really going for 3 or 4 years, and the musicianship is absolutely superb. I think what's very, very significant about October is it's a very fragile album, and it was recorded under very fragile terms. They had no preparation for it. They were literally touring boy like crazy. There was no opportunity to do any songwriting, and they literally had, you know, a few weeks to record the album in the summer of 1981. So the whole thing was very, very difficult and very, very fraught. And of course, we've all heard about the problems that Bono had with the lost lyrics and the lost briefcase. So the whole period for them was very, very difficult. And it's an album that, you know, will be looked back on as being underrated or least played or whatever. But, you know, without that album, U2 wouldn't be the band they were right here and right now. We can say that with all the albums, but, you know, it's an absolutely important album. It really put the anchor in the landscape for U2. No two ways about it.
Yeah. I would agree with that, because I'd probably even go even a step further, in so much as, you know, if it wasn't for October, there wouldn't be a U2. So, you know, there's all the kind of well-documented sort of religious angst that was going on, certainly amongst three of the band members. There's the did Edge or did he not leave the band for a couple of weeks sort of scenario that was going on.
That's right.
And you know, that combined with, as you said, very little rehearsal, lost lyrics, tunes they weren't really quite sure what to do with, but they kind of got themselves through it. And you know, born out of that was War, I guess, if you want. And I think for me, that's why it's such a, you know, if I think about it just purely in U2 history terms, that's why I think it's really, really important. Apart from the fact I think it's got some great tunes on it, personally. But I do think it's such a significant album in that sense. And there's always been significant elements in the U2 history, and I think that's definitely one of them.
Yeah, I was curious, Aaron, even, I don't know if you remember back then exactly the sort of that idea, because looking back on it, we do kind of, as U2 fans and historians or whatever, it's kind of, what's the word, mythologized as far as like them, this like myth, they might be breaking up, the Christian, you know, faith stuff that was going on, religious stuff, and like what's happening with U2. Was that, I guess you weren't necessarily a huge fan of the band before, like you said, War came out, and that's kind of what made you go back to it. But was that even a question of stuff that people would have been aware of at the time, or is that just more now that we know, you know, looking back?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I certainly didn't pick up on the religious aspect. Obviously Worked Out, it was a religious album, but I didn't have any real inkling or understanding of their involvement with Shalom, you know, which is the Christian fellowship they were involved with for a good while, actually. And also all their friends and many of the associates of the band, you know, were involved in that. And as Kenny said, yeah, I mean, at one point Edge left the band. He literally left the band around the time of just after the Boy tour had finished for a few days, if only. But they had a lot of pressure amongst themselves, and the relationships between Adam and Larry and Edge and Bono really were very, very difficult for a long, long time, as they were with their own families. So it was a very difficult album for them to record. And I think, you know, Island Records in the UK or the World Record Label, if it was now, that wouldn't have happened. They would have dropped them before they had even got to record that album. So very different times.
Yeah.
So a lot of faith in the album, a lot of faith in U2 in getting that album recorded. And I think Steve Lillywhite as well is another unsung hero for this album because, you know, he didn't want to do two albums in a row with any of his acts. Of course, he'd already done that with U2. And, of course, here he is back in the studio just literally 1 year on recording again with U2. And, you know, the album really has not been a great fond album for U2 fans over the years, but I go back to it a lot and I love it. I love the atmosphere of the album. It's almost a very, very unique sound. I agree, some of the songs are not strong and some of the albums are just songs are just filler. There's no two ways about it, but that's only because they've released such a phenomenal amount of songs and albums since. But at the time, you didn't think that.
Yeah, that's what... Mike, how about you? What's your relationship, as it were, with October?
Matt brought up something on the Boy podcast about how these guys were just kids, right? He mentioned that.
Yeah.
They were the age of his son right now, and yet they're making music and they're touring the world or parts of the world, and they were still just little boys, essentially, when this came out. And the thing that the cover band guy said about reaching and seeking and all that is all good. I came to this was probably my third album. I'm a Blood Red Sky guy. That's the one that made me go back. But I think that that's a good point that you made about because we know what they sound like now, this sounds like they're play acting the U2 of the future. But within that, you can hear how eager they are to own the world, right? Even though these songs are not particularly good and some of the lyrics are just laughable, but it does in fact have a vibe. And I think it hit me personally at an exact time that I needed that vibe in my life. And its inaccessibility made it more of a favorite. Like if you didn't get this album, then you weren't going to be my really good friend, even though it's kind of depressing and sad and makes you all introspective and whatever. And incidentally, I just have to speak up for the non-believers in the audience. The religious stuff on this album goes completely over my head, and I still play it all the time without that even being a part of it, which I think is part of the genius of their writing lyrics and that can be interpreted in a million different ways. And I realize that the word rejoice is all over the place, but that could just mean I'm really, really happy.
Yeah.
Because my football team won or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't necessarily have to be God, although most people agree that this is their God album, which is extra ironic that it's the one that I like so much. I can't figure it out either. But I was 16 and I shared these cassettes with girls that I crushed on. And the ones I got closer to were the ones that went home and listened with their headphones. And then we talked about it the next day. I mean, I cannot. That's all tied up. All the adolescence is tied up with this album for me.
That's interesting. So it's kind of like the modern swipe right. Or
a
swipe
little
left.
Bit. Yes, it took 40 minutes, though. It wasn't quite so fast.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. The one interesting thing that I noticed that I had no idea, I don't know how much this is a part of U2 lore or not, but Fire was recorded apparently in the Bahamas during a break on the Boy Tour, the rest of the album being recorded at Windmill Lane in Dublin. But just kind of interesting when you think of the band at that time, and like I don't associate the band with Island, or I mean, they're on an island.
Island Records.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like the sort of Bahamas sitting back. And I mean, now you see pictures of them, Adam, obviously, et cetera, all over the world and stuff. But yeah, for me, it's kind of like, I think of them as this gritty band in rainy Dublin, like Aaron said earlier, and, you know, dark and gray and not like coming in from the beach and trying to record their follow-up album or whatever.
It was, I think that was, now, if memory serves me right, was that Chris Blackwell who owned...
It's Compass Point Studios, Nassau,
yeah,
in the Bahamas.
Yeah,
they have something to do with...
It's a working holiday or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah. It is. It is during the break on a tour in 81. It was the Easter, wasn't it? April of 81. And from what I remember, they carried on a bit more of the tour. Then they started playing some of the festivals and whatever. And in fact, if I remember right, during the period in Wimmer Lane, they even played Slane Castle amongst That's all right. of this. So their first appearance in Slane, they previewed some of the songs. I can't remember which ones they were. It may have been With a Shout and stuff like that. Songs they actually very rarely played, even during the October tour in the subsequent fall and the following year. But it was kind of crazy what they were doing at the time, because, you know, the whole approach was very, very difficult for them, and they made it more difficult by deciding to play some shows whilst recording the album.
Yeah.
I want to, if I could, Chris, could I, for in case there's listeners out there that don't know the story about the briefcase, can you guys quickly do a bullet point or, yeah.
Yeah, just, I don't know if Kenny or Aaron, if you have a better handle on the story.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, for years and years, this was a lot of mythology. And, of course, Bono, being Bono, blamed the lack of songwriting or the perceived songwriting, the poor lyrics, being blamed on him having his briefcase stolen after a show in Portland, Oregon. I can't remember when. I think it was around February, March 1981.
I'm reading from the other Aaron's webpage, so this is not me. He says, the foghorn in Portland, Oregon, on March 22nd, 1981.
There you go. That wasn't bad, was it? And it wasn't too
very
far.
Specific. Yeah, good job right there.
And so, yeah, that was lost. And I can't remember when, but I certainly remember at U2 breaking the news. Was it around 2001, the briefcase, if not the briefcase, the contents of the briefcase, which was the scrapbook and various jottings that Bono had improvised lyrics and the like, were found in the United States, I think, again, near Portland, Oregon. And they were then presented to Bono during one of the shows in that area in 2001 on the Elevation Tour. And I think there was lots of photographs shown on the website at the time. I'm sure it's in the archive, on the U2 archive. And in reality, it was just scribblings, you know, just nonsense that Bono had lost lyrics, really. There really wasn't very much in there at all. Just the jottings of a 21, 22-year-old kid, as they say. So, yeah, I think that... But I think losing the briefcase probably knocked Bono's confidence in terms of the songwriting and the pressure that he was then under, literally singing at the microphone. And I don't think that's really changed this day. I mean, they put themselves under a lot of pressure. The songwriting style hasn't changed, but, you know, it's the difficult second album. You've had the whole lifetime to write the first one, and as usual, just a few months to write the second one.
It proves how little they were... how little power they had back then, as they shouldn't have. They were only 20-ish. But the fact that they had the studio time, couldn't cancel it or postpone it, right? So they had to show up without lyrics. He could make them up on the spot, which we've seen him do all the time. And I remember that that Unforgettable Fire video where they kind of show the making of it, and he's just trying stuff when he's singing Pride. Mm. He's trying different things, right? And they arrive at some catharsis, and they find the perfect way of singing it. But that's back when they had the money and the freedom, and they had the whole castle to themselves to record it. Yeah. Right? Like when this was going on, they had a 2-month window or less where they had to get in and get out. They didn't have the money to pay for it. And as when I used to review movies, I would often say that the smaller the budget, the more creativity had to spring from that. Because you were forced to make creative decisions that you couldn't make if you had extra money or extra power. And I kind of see that here, where they know that they're going to have to do this stuff. They've lost Bono's scribblings. He's going to have to make it up on the spot. And they're, you know, with limited success, it actually works. Because some of the lyrics are ridiculous. And the song Scarlet only has one word. So why did Bono bother showing up for that? you know, but you can just see that they had to, you know, it's like when you have an essay due and you wait till the last minute, and you sometimes have genius and you sometimes have terrible stuff.
Yeah.
But I like the chaos of this album a lot because of that.
And interesting, Michael, what you say there about the chaos. Despite all the chaos, despite all of the fractiousness going in the background, it's actually their calmest album.
Yeah. No, that's all true.
You know, it's a very peaceful album. And going back to what you said, Michael, as well, about the you know, just having that 6 or 8 week period in the summer of 1981 to record the album, they literally have put every song, everything they could record on that album. I mean, we talked about Fire being recorded 3 or 4 months earlier. So it's an 11-track album. One has already been cut. They've got 10 more tracks that they put down. Two of them are virtually instrumentals in Scarlet and Is That All. Even October is really just a short piano piece with some lyrics on. There isn't very much on that album. And even the 2008 remastered edition, you know, you buy that in the hope, wow, there'll be some other golden tracks that have never been recorded before, released before, sorry, and there's nothing.
Yeah, there is nothing. Is no stuff in the vault at this
stage. That's right.
Well, we're quickly approaching the 1 hour mark of the podcast, and we have yet to start going song by song, which is what we're hoping to do. So maybe we'll do the if you're exhausted at this point with October, we've probably talked more than the band spent recording. No, I'm just kidding. send Michael the hate mail. No, I'm just kidding. I like the album. Don't get mad at me. Hey, at you two listeners, I will just give you a bit of a break from the October discussion to quickly thank a sponsor of this episode and actually of this podcast. Feed Press have been providing the hosting and feed support for the podcast as it gets sent out around the world to you listeners. They do RSS analytics. So if you have a blog and maybe you need some analytics on the RSS feed and who's reading and following you on your blog, or if you have a podcast and you want some hosting for your podcast, you can visit feed.press/ATU2 to try FeedPress for 14 days, no contracts or commitments. And then you can use promo code ATU2 during checkout to get 10% off your whole first year of hosting with them. 400 megabytes of storage, which is enough for a podcast like At You Too, for sure, per month, that rolls over each month. So check them out, feed.press/ATU2. Our thanks to them for supporting the At You Too podcast, as well as goodstuff.fm. Now back to the show. One thing I wanted to mention, Kevin, at Kevin STU, mentioned on Twitter, as well as part of the Ask At You Too questions, was please discuss the emergence of October during U2's Innocence and Experience tour and the lyrics in the context of today's global society, which is a heady question to drop into as well. But definitely for someone like myself, I vastly appreciate old U2 in the context of new current U2, especially live U2, and that's often has been an avenue for me to sort of go back to the archives. Because like Aaron, I think it was earlier alluded to, for me, listening to the album now does feel very dated. I said this on the boy discussion as well. There's certain songs that just kind of like scream 80s kids, whatever. And some of them, it just kind of puts me in a weird place as far as music stylings and lyrics sometimes too, and doesn't really connect me to the current U2. But having a song like October in the live set, and especially the way it was used very appropriately in the live set to highlight what was going on in the world, is a great kind of like connecting point for me anyways, going back to the older stuff. So anyways, at that point, let's segue, now that I've discussed October, which isn't the first song on the album, let's head into the album discussion or song discussion of the album. So Gloria is obviously the first song on the album, and probably very familiar to most folks. U2 has played it numerous times over the years, but
yeah, I mean, Gloria is obviously the opening track. It gently comes in. As I say, it's a very gentle sounding album, and the way Lily White's done the production is great. And I think, you know, how Gloria comes in, we've got a chorus of Latin, you know, that's pretty brave for a 20-year-old
rock and roll
band. And we've got Gloria in Te Domine, Gloria Exultate, you know, all of that is, wow, you know, you can't believe what you're hearing. We've got a great bass solo. We've got a great sliding guitar solo.
Wait. I have to stop you. Is the bass solo great?
I love it.
Yeah. This is where maybe again. Go ahead, Kenny.
I was going to say, I think his hair gets in the way somewhere along the lines.
That's what we didn't talk about, the album cover and Adam. As a, just Adam is a whole episode on himself, I think, that we could discuss at some point. And I'm sure there's plenty of people who'd love to talk about Adam for hours. But I listen to the bass solo and I think there's a kid who was told he has to put a bass solo in, has no idea how to do a bass solo, and just like slaps the bass for a while. And I know I'm not like the haters on, or the lovers of Adam and bass stuff in general. I appreciate that it still does take skill and talent to do what he did. I'm not just saying that he's like, you know, there's the people who think Adam can only play With or Without You style bass lines or whatever. And I know that's not the case. He's a very talented bass player. But to me, when I hear it, I think, yeah, it's like, I, as a musician, I can totally feel that, that moment when the lead singer looks over to you for the solo and you're like, this song is in a key. I have no idea how I'm going to play a solo, and I'm going to just try and do something here and hopefully it works. And so anyways, that's a 2 minute rant on Adam's bass.
No, I understand. I understand. But it is, you know, it is of its time, isn't it? And, Adam obviously thinks he's quite cool. I can see that. Yeah. I can see where you're coming from.
Remember the live shows in that era, that's when he could point to him and say, Adam Clayton. And right. Then he'd do his little boop, boop, boop. That's right. That's right. On the other hand, though, what Chris was just saying, that's the bass line. I'm not a musician at all. That's the bass line I would learn. So at parties, when people go, can you play any bass? I'd go, can I? Step aside. Here I go, boop, boop, boo, boop, boop, boo. And I'd be the hit of the party.
Do you know, he might actually not have played the bass at all, but he might have just done what you've done, just go, boo, boo, boo. Yeah.
Of course, that Gloria ended up on MTV, didn't it? Yeah, that was
the first rotating video, wasn't it? Yeah.
That's right. The video on the barge in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I'd like to speak up for the harmony, which I wish they had done more of. This might be the last time that kind of thing happens, where I go like, oh my God, they're like a choir.
Right,
but it's a, what is it? It's a Gregorian chant, I think, is the description, isn't it? How it's described as.
Yeah,
but that's good stuff.
Yeah, Fabiano in the chat room has suggested Gloria, a great bass solo, as a title for this episode. So if I lose my lose the battle, you'll know that was right. It was not my choice. But anyways, I Fall Down is the next track. One note I had, and Kenny, you can maybe jump in on this one, but is on the musician side, I guess, acoustic guitar sounds that you don't actually often hear these days and don't associate that much with U2, kind of prevalent throughout this song. But Kenny, you had some thoughts on I Fall Down.
Yeah, actually, the musicality of this song, I think, is kind of fairly underrated, actually. And I'm with you, it's kind of edge in the keyboard piece, which sort of came to life throughout the album on certain tracks, which I think at the time, I think Bono has said, I remember reading it somewhere, he said we didn't realise that Edge could play the piano, and Edge said he didn't realise he could play the piano either. So so that kind of came through in this track. But part actually why I quite like this track, I like the, I guess the kind of, well, I actually like the lyrics in this. And I know we've actually talked about the fact that a lot of the stuff is pretty minimal, to say the least, as in one word, etc. But I like there's a bit of storytelling in this one. You know, Julie says, John, I'm getting nowhere. I wrote this letter, hope to get to someplace soon. I just think that's such a great opening two or three lines, you know. So, I guess for me, that's why that resonates with me. I just like and allegedly it's about, you know, as per usual, it's Bono relating it to, I can't remember who it was, but it was somebody.
I think it's Pod, isn't it? It's Pod from the Virgin Prunes, who is a near neighbour in Cedarwood Road, and Pod was actually a roadie for U2 for the Boy tour and through most of the October tour.
This was a good scream in your car vocalist thing for those of you frustrated singers out there, because you just yell, you fall down. Everybody can do that. I don't even know what it was about, but I could sing that part loudly. It's good. We don't know. Who is Julie to Pod? What's the?
Well, I think Julie is.
Pod's girlfriend.
As I understand, Julie was Pod's girlfriend. Yeah, and Pod's real name is Anthony Murphy. So he isn't John, but it's an illusion, isn't it, obviously?
Yes.
But, I can't remember where I've read that, actually. I don't know where I've got that in my memory bank, to be honest with you, but it's probably in the Niall Stokes book or something like that. But, yeah, it's a great song. It's a real upbeat song, actually, despite the lyrics.
I love it. Cool, very cool. Okay, moving on. I'm gonna keep us moving. I threw a brick through a window. The one note I had was just the heavy tom-tom intro and outro by Larry. And perhaps I'm wondering if maybe Bono was in there helping on the tom-toms, just like a bit of stress relief on the drums, trying to get the lyrics out as they recorded and just wanted to hit something for a while just to help jog his brain going in through. But
I think I tell you what I would say about it. Michael was talking about, I Fall Down being one of those ones for singing in the car. I think I threw bricks kind of for all you air drummers out there. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. Absolutely love it. Yeah.
Well,
I think,
just turn it up and put headphones on.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely something for anybody who, like, hopefully you have the experience. Obviously, you can put the music on a great big stereo, obviously, in your house or whatever, but listening to some of the earlier stuff, especially on headphones, and getting to experience a bit more of the different recording styles and obviously things that aren't quite so. What's the word? Precise and fine that, recordings nowadays can be with computers obviously involved, where they were actually, recording onto tapes and things like that.
The great thing about the October album as well, it's recorded all on analog tape. It's really hissy soundboard. It's not a very great one. It's probably only a 16-track recording studio at the time in 81 in Wimmer Lane. And I was very fortunate to go to Wimmer Lane a couple of times in the early 80s, right through to Unforgettable Fire. And it was tiny, absolutely tiny. So the drum sound, you can understand, the drums being taken out of the studio, being put in the reception area, the footwell, I remember. I've got some photographs of that. And you can understand how Lady White got the sound, with the hanging microphones down from the top end of the studio. And it is that's why I love this album. It has such a unique sound. It's really experimental.
Yeah.
I want to say two things about this, Chris. One, it's got the quote that people put on their bumper stickers and their signature lines on email going forward, which was, "No one is blinder than he who will not see." So that became like a religious touchstone for some of my friends that were fans. And also, this is a song, this plus I Fall Down, I would use as Exhibit A when people laugh in present-day concerts when Bono says, "We grew up on punk, we were a punk band." And people go, "You guys are millionaires flying in Learjets. You don't know what punk is." And what punk is to me is a group of people that don't exactly know how to play. Exhibit A is Adam's bass solo. The lyrics aren't particularly strong. They don't make that much sense. But the passion behind it is enough to make up for that at a young stage. This is a punk album to me, even though it also has a calm mood. And it's got a lot of God in it. I just find that this is a bunch of 20-year-olds trying to find their way, which is kind of what I think punk is. I like this song a lot.
Yeah.
And Michael, you're right, because I threw a brick through a window. If you listen to Larry's drum patterns, he's all over the place. He's completely out of tempo.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's lovely to hear that. You don't want to hear the perfection all the time.
Yeah, that's what I remember my guitar instructor years ago making fun of you too, because he couldn't stand that Larry couldn't hold a beat or whatever. This is a relative to a very picky, anal retentive guitar metronome kind of guy or whatever. So I definitely appreciate where Michael's coming from as far as the punk side of it too, because we've all heard bands that have the technique and have even the lyric, but don't have the enthusiasm or the emotion or the energy, and it just falls flat and you can't go anywhere. And the energy and enthusiasm for the band, for the songs, and the belief in the songs, even more importantly, I think, is what comes through tremendously on this album. So moving on is Rejoice, which we've talked about. There's a bit of rejoicing on this album.
It's
except it's got, I was reading a quote from one of the books where Bono said, what idiot on their second album has the word rejoice that often in the lyrics? A word that's sure to send people running from the record. And yet I found a way to still sing along. I don't know. I might just be the blindest fan out there when it comes to October, where I'm just singing without even knowing what I'm singing about.
I think your perspective, though, that you alluded to earlier of, like, you know, not having the same faith or whatever that they're into, but still finding the music. Because often anybody who has that faith is kind of like, holds up U2 as like, see, look, you know, or whatever. And
yes,
like
yes. You said, the number one Christian band that's ever existed.
Yeah.
I get that a lot, right? And yet I don't have any of the Christian part, and they're still the number one band that ever existed to me. I can only imagine what you guys are going through. It must be spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Lots of rejoicing. Anyway,
yes.
that particular song, though, has for me the best lyric on the album. I love it. I can't change the world, but I can change the world in me. That is a brilliant line.
Mm-hmm. And again, especially in context, right? That's where it's hard for us to look now, 2016, remember back to that idea, because obviously that's a theme that's underscored a lot of what Bono's doing, although he has tried to change the world as well.
Yes.
But yeah, definitely carried that through. So moving on to Fire is the next song that's... Kenny or Aaron, anybody?
I hate this song.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
All right.
No, I really can't stand it. But I was very pleased. I mean, this is another one which, you know, you can't quite understand. When you buy, I bought Boy, and my version of the vinyl has this little, at the end of Shadow and Tall Trees, has this little screeching guitar that's in the distance, and you're thinking, that's strange. And you hear October, and of course it's the... It's basically a rough guitar solo for Fire, as you hear it. So obviously the song Fire was going around for a long, long time, and it was only, of course, when we had the Boy remastered edition, we get to hear Saturday Night, which is obviously the first time they recorded Fire. So they recorded Fire as a totally different lyric, a different style of melody, but the backing track effectively is the same song. So they must have done that back in 1980. So Fire, but Fire, I just don't like. I can't stand it. And, you know, isn't this the song where they play Top of the Pops in the UK? And they play the song and it actually goes down the following week by their appearance.
Wow.
First time on, and they all wore black badly, I think.
They all wore black,
described it. Yeah.
and Bono can't even mime to his own lyrics. I mean, good God. It's one of the most dreadful Top of the Pops performances of all time. And, you know, I think Bono would be the first one to admit to that. It's dreadful.
I quite liked it live, but I agree. And when on the recording, it's a bit, particularly the opening part of it, it's a bit painful. Mm.
I had in my notes just definitely sounds of its time in the early 80s. Like it's...
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I'm pleasantly surprised we found a track that Aaron vehemently has no problem.
Yep. I would set it on fire.
All right, so let's move on before Aaron burns the place down. Tomorrow. I had noted just the rare inclusion of actual Irish instruments in it. The I don't know how you pronounce it even. Ullian pipes.
We have a source right here.
Yeah. And this is a song. This is a great song. This is a song that is, again, another song in the theme of Bono's mother. We know the background behind this song. This is a song written about his dead mother, who'd been, how many years, about 7 years past. And, you know, it's in the line of I Will Follow, it's in the line of Mofo, all the songs that we know, Iris. This is a great song. It's the most Irish-sounding song, clearly, because of the introduction of the Ullian pipes. sorry to be a nerd on here. Who's that one? Vinnie Kilduff plays on this the backing track. It gives it a unique sound. It's absolutely beautiful, particularly the outro when the combination of the five musicians effectively with Vinnie Kilduff playing on top, and it's just a beautiful melody.
Which, when you say now, like thinking about it, like he's 21 when he records this, and what did you say? He's 7 years gone on from when his mother
passed in 74.
Yeah, having watched the songs "Innocence and Experience" concert video, and when he's talking about it in there with Iris or whatever, about his mom passing, it's as this 50-something-year-old guy who's talking about it, you know, from 50 or 40 something years ago, and it's kind of just this thing in the past and whatever. But like, yeah, when you think about it at that stage, like that's still relatively fresh, raw, you know, it's a thing he's going to sing about now around the world. And the
passion in his voice when he sings it, you really feel for the guy. Mm-hmm. You know,
this is the best song. You're exactly
right. I would agree.
This is the one where the mood of it, you're in his head immediately. Even if you haven't lost your own mother, you're thinking of something you have lost or someone you have lost. I like that they remade this later on for that Irish record was just Adam and Bono together. I like everything about this, right? I mean, it's
the Common Ground album.
Yeah. I like the live versions. I like this studio thing. It's got the word Jesus in there, and yet I still love it. So it is. This is a good one right here.
Yeah.
And it's on the remastered deluxe edition too. So if completest, if anybody doesn't have it that would want it, I'm sure they already have it because why would you not, I guess, at this point. But it is on that, and links to that album in the show notes, of course, iTunes and Spotify or whatever, you can find it there just to take a listen because I hadn't really realized that. And yeah, going back and listening to that alternate version, it's worth checking out for sure.
I think as well that this is another one for me, you know, because there is this irony around about the whole lyrics and stuff like that, but it's really powerful. And he paints... You know the picture he paints. You know that somebody's knocking at the door. There's a black car parked at the side of the road. You know, it's just I agree with everybody else. I think this is the standout track for a whole variety of reasons, and I think it's hugely emotional. Actually,
And I think the choice of the Ulian pipe in particular makes the song. I mean, it'd be interesting to hear it without the Ulian pipe. It would be such a different song, and it makes the whole, as I said, the outro. It just soars. It just lifts off completely, goes up a key. It's fantastic.
There are some live versions with more of the pipey stuff, which makes it even better.
Yeah.
So yeah, good stuff. Wow, we agree. Chris, what about you? Do you hate that one too?
No, I definitely love that song. And moving on to October, which, like I said earlier, has been featured was in the last tour in a unique way.
October, and the trees are stripped bare of all they wear. What do I care?
It becomes a prefix to New Year's Day later on. Most people have seen it coupled with that. There are not many words to it, and it is so vast as to have no actual meaning, but you can put whatever you want on there. Those are my favorite songs. This was also a piano that it was like a hidden track. So you think you're getting a rock and roll album, and then there's a piano part. And I remember that most bands of this era would have sort of this is not a love song, but a quiet song mixed in with all the big ones. I remember The Alarm doing something like this. My favorite Zeppelin song was a quiet one that I would send to girls. It's all about the girls here. But this was before the word existed, every emo person's like, this is the one. No one understands me. I'm an adolescent. I got to put my stupid orange headphones on that existed back in 1982 and sit there and listen to this. And I don't really know what it's about, but I know it makes me feel, right? We used to need excuses to feel certain ways when you're young. When you're old, you just feel and you can't stop it. But when you're young, you need to like this, I must be sad and this song is going to be perfect. But I loved hearing it live because the arena gets quiet and everybody's impressed that Edge is playing piano. I like that. People are singing along without really knowing what they're singing about. And it's very, very short. I just think it's different than most of the other stuff that they did then and even since. Mm-hmm. Right. just sitting down at the piano, the two of them. The metronome, I always thought was kind of weird. Like, maybe Edge needed that because he wasn't such a good piano player. I don't know, but the click, click, click that we have.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so different from the other stuff. I guess that's what I like about it.
And interesting, in the most recent concert document or video, you can kind of hear when Edge plays the intro and he pauses before Bono comes in. You can hear fans, it's hard to tell if they're like clapping in appreciation that Edge played the piano and it's just kind of like we're moving and before the lyric starts, or if they're just thinking that's all it is, it's just like this funny little instrumental that, you know, how familiar they are with the actual song.
Yeah.
But yeah, it comes, again, speaking as a fan, the Yaktongue Baby and Forward fan or whatever, it's a beautiful way to get introduced or reintroduced to that song for sure, with a shout.
Yeah, I'm totally with Michael, by the way, on this. I like the album not for religious reasons. I like it for it being what it is, the tunes and everything. This song is probably about as religious as you can get, I guess. It certainly mentions Jerusalem quite a few times, etc. But this song for me is exhausting, but in a really, really good way. I love the tempo of it. There's certain key changes in it which I just think are absolutely sublime, and there's a particular point I always go whoa at when the song comes on. It's the and it's the bit when they talk about going to the foot of Mount Zion, to the foot of He Who Made Me See. Now, that's not, I don't say that because of what he's actually talking about in relation to that. It's just the energy and passion. I think somebody mentioned earlier on about the passion, and actually I think the song's in a way quite punky actually, so again it's a driving song, it's full of energy. I think it takes a lot of flack actually, so it does from certain corners of the U2 kingdom out there, but I just think it's fabulous.
This is a song that, if I recall, Bono has discussed in the past about reading the Psalms of David from the Old Testament. So I think a lot of the lyrics go back to that. And I'm no theologian, but this is a song that he really wears his heart in his sleeve, as you say, because that it is a very passionate song. He really lets go on this one, I think.
Yeah, he definitely, like Michael had said too, it's hard to, like, even being as uninterested as you are in any sort of Jesus stuff, I guess, or whatever, is the one, like, I want to go to the foot of the Messiah, to the foot of He Who Made Me, like you said, Kenny. And it's kind of like that dual, like, great lyric just on its own, and never mind any sort of Christian Jesus stuff, but then also obviously having that connecting point for those who do is kind of like really cool as well. So the sort of duality that they sort of straddle both worlds with that very well. So
for most of this album, I don't have to believe, but I have to believe that they believe, and that's good enough for me, right? It's not like they're faking this. This is not a way to sell more albums, to have lyrics like this, right? They're, especially, you know, in the cool early 80s.
Yeah, mentioning Jerusalem like that and Messiah and stuff, unless it was like rock god Messiah coming or whatever.
They're not kidding around, and I can see that, and it makes the music better to me.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, Stranger in a Strange Land. I'm trying to keep us under 2 hours here, so we'll keep going. But
I'm failing.
Yeah, I know.
Part of the reason, this is a particular favourite again for me, but it was written in relation to when they were in Berlin, etc. But I actually prefer to kind of look at it through almost the lens of a sort of early Sunday Bloody Sunday. And it's been discussed before that it's got connotations or certainly linkages to the troubles in Northern Ireland, you know, and You know, the soldier asks for a cigarette, his smiling face, I can't forget. I mean, I just think some fantastic lyrics in there. So for me, it's a kind of a strange song in a way, where it sits on the album, particularly after being completely exhausted after With a Shout. But great song. And as I say, just the great lyrics.
Very cool. Okay. Where are we here? Scarlet.
These are the hardest lyrics of all.
I was going to say,
profound.
Yeah. I mean, this is a song Bob Dylan would be proud of, wouldn't he? Eh? Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. Where are we? Yeah, seriously, I love this song. Actually, daft as it sounds, I'd love to know why it's called Scarlet.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody?
I don't know.
No idea.
It's got all the chimes that, you know, U2 becomes famous for. It sounds like a bunch of bells playing, but what is it trying to tell us? Why is it Scarlet? No man can say.
This for me was my personal highlight. To hear this on the 360 tour was just outstanding. And what a thing to play.
Such a strange track to play, wasn't
it? In the middle of, you know, stadiums that were holding 90,000 people. I mean, it was just incredible to play that.
Yeah, and it's an interesting connecting point, I guess, back to like what we were saying of this, there being their sophomore out or second album, and they're, you know, having to follow up the big hit and stuff, and they still put stuff like this on the album. And then still having a bit of that spirit of doing that on a live, like there's obviously, they know they can play some of, get away with playing some of the old cuts, and they'll have the hardcore fans who are like salivating and drooling because they're playing those songs live. But still, it takes guts to play that in a 30 some thousand or whatever stadium where, you know, half the audience is going to be booing if they don't play With or Without You or whatever. And to stick a song like this in.
I generally can't remember whether it was ever played before live. You know, it really, to me, I don't think it was.
It was on a radio show, probably the Kid Jensen.
Or
Richard Skinner, I think it was.
Skinner, that's right, in the BBC in England. What a song to pull out of the out of the bag.
Yeah, on YouTube.com, they list it as being on their song archive anyways, just starting 2010, which is, what is that, the 360 tour, right, that we're talking
360
about?
360 tour, yeah.
Until 2011.
I mean, we have got a website called tours.attitude2.com. We ought to look at it. I mean, I actually...
It's too bad somebody doesn't work on that site who knows about SEO and stuff, because U2's site is popping up ahead of it for some reason right now. But we'll see. This will be the test to see if Matt has listened this far. Okay, finally, the last song, and maybe what you're asking about with this podcast is that all?
Is that all?
Aaron, you want to cover?
Yeah, I mean, this is, it's a jaunty little track, isn't it, at the end? I mean, it again has another relationship to being a bit desperate, obviously trying to fill 40 minutes, two sides of 12-inch vinyl, and they've obviously got to get the last track in. And it's a recut of a intro song that called The Cry that was combined with... the Electrico, pretty much from the whole of the Boy Tour right through to, probably was played through to the Unforgettable Fire Tour, I think, Kenny, wasn't it? I don't think they've played it since then. And, of course, we would know it. Lots of people know it anyhow, The Cry, even if they don't know the song title itself. They would know it from Under a Blood Red Sky, for sure. Is that all? It's the same backing track, effectively, the same intro, the same... the same start to it with the guitar and the call from Bono. It also ends in a bit of a clatter and bang, doesn't it, with the guys almost like abandoning their instruments and walking away, and everybody's doing a bit of a whistle. And it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you hear all this bang and clatter and then it all goes very, very calm and just stops.
Yeah, to read the lyrics independent of even the music or whatever, and in light of all the stuff we've talked about, obviously, with the album and the lyrics disappearing, et cetera, and the stress in the band, it is kind of a funny one to, like, Otising the song makes me happy, I'm not happy with you. Otising the song makes me dance. Is that all? Kind of like, okay, finally, we've got the last song. I don't know if they actually recorded this.
So is that all you want from me?
Yeah, like as if they're speaking to the record label or their manager at the hall or whatever, and like just kind of like, let's get to the pub. We want to be done this one already and move on kind of thing. But yeah, still a interesting way to end in this album.
It's definitely the song that is, they must have had literally the last day, the last half hour, and they had to do something there and then. A bit like 40. Regretfully, it doesn't have the classic...
Yeah, nobody's singing this at the end.
The classic of 40.
We hold our hands up. Is that all? They leave one at a time. Imagine how the band could have been different. Yes, this totally smells like a filler, even though I like singing it. But yeah, I can picture them, like the guys turning the lights off while they finish up, and they got to get out of there.
Somebody sweeping the floor.
Despite all of these songs, despite some of the songs being a bit naff, even Fire, even Is That All, I would not change the track listing. I wouldn't want to hear 1 second less. I wouldn't want to hear 1 second all. I love this album. I really do.
Totally agree.
Yeah, definitely. And that's where I think if you are, like we've talked about, a later U2 fan and haven't gone back to listen to the earlier stuff, hopefully these episodes are inspiring you to maybe go back and check them out, album from start to finish, and re-listen if you haven't listened in a while anyways. Definitely just a fun little experiment, I guess, and a fun little journey back through U2's history that way. Not attempting to be exhaustive, obviously, in every single detail of the album, but just to have a fun discussion around the table of what we like and don't like about Adam's bass solo on Gloria. So next up we'll be covering War, which I don't have the list in front of me. There's folks who are, the way we're doing this, by the way, in case you're curious, is I put a list together basically for the At U2 staff and just said, here's the album. Obviously everybody knows the albums, but here's the list and the order we're doing in, which is also fairly obvious, and throw your name down and we'll get a group together to talk about each album. So
I also understand, Chris, within the staff rules that each podcast has to get longer. Right. So by the time we get to Songs of Innocence, it will be a 14-hour podcast.
I'm going to need a new computer to be able to record it alone.
Go buy an external. You'll need it.
All right. We might have to do double side albums, I guess, or whatever, for double album releases for the future podcasts. So Aaron, why don't you kick us off? Where can folks find you if they want to disagree or agree with some of your comments on...
You can catch me on Twitter on at Ivanobe, IvanObe. I'm no doubt on Facebook as Aaron Govan. That's a very big surprise there. I'm write OTRs as well, so contact me via the Twitter page. But please come to Dublin.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And if nothing else, I want to see many selfies with Aaron progressively throughout the night.
I might even get up on stage just to say and sing a bit of a ditty.
Oh, right.
Nice. I hope it's Scarlet.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yes. Well, I won't struggle with the lyrics at least. Yeah.
Or is that all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Kenny? Where can folks find you and follow you if they want?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Sing No More. As the word says.
That's probably what will happen to me when they get
on. Yeah, absolutely. Too right. And I'm also on the forum. I'm one of the forum mods, so come and have a bit of banter with me there. And likewise, I'm heading to Dublin as well. So if any of you are kicking about and I've given up doing selfies with Aaron, come and selfie with me.
There we go. Autographs with famous members of the At U2 podcast. Who survived 2 hour recordings. And Michael Vox, what were we supposed to say? Michael Vox, answer guy.
I'm jealous that I will not be in Dublin. Yeah. I want to hear all about it. So be sure to give us the, remember how we all felt at the New York show when those guys showed up and we weren't there, but we were kind of there. Mm-hmm. I want you guys to do that for us.
We'll have Periscope on the go. I'm sure.
Yes, we will. If you could do that, please. You could Tim Neufeld. I'm at Michael Vox once in a while on Twitter and all over the place.
All right. Awesome. And I'm iChris on Twitter. And this episode of the podcast, you can find at goodstuff.fm/A2. It's been too long.
A2.
My brain, my words aren't lettering anymore. Goodstuff.fm/ATU2/35 is where you can find this episode. You can follow the At U2 crew on Twitter at ATU2 and Facebook.com/ATU2com. Be sure to check out the album, of course. There's links in the show notes to the album on various services. If you have not ever, for whatever reason, have never checked it out, and maybe you don't want to go back to the old U2 just because of Adam's hair or whatever on the cover, get past that and listen to a great album from the archives of U2 that, like we said, shaped the band into who they are today, no doubt. So thank you for listening. We'll be back next episode discussing War. And be sure to send in questions, comments about the podcast, either this one that just happened, or if you have comments about War that you want to interject into the show, use the hashtag #AskAtU2, and we'll definitely take your comments and questions into the next episode. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Bye.
Is that all?